All right, so the conclusion from the definition of marriage and sexual immorality is that as a violation of the boundaries established at creation, homosexuality is a sin. Now, notably, a strategy in gay exegesis of Scripture on this topic marginalizes marriage as a creation ordinance. I think this is pretty rampant through the literature. So instead of comparing homosexuality with marriage, these exegetes emphasize the comparison of heterosexuality with homosexuality. And this is what I added to our notes last time that are on the website posting. This strategy fragments and distorts the biblical picture, elevating human sexuality disproportionately, and opening the door for simply finding one's preference. When we compare homosexuality with marriage, you know, as a different way to go than what this gay exegesis goes, when we compare homosexuality with marriage, we keep all of Scripture squarely before us, emphasizing God's design of male and female for marriage with the potentiality of procreation in a covenant of companionship for life. Big picture, which was sweep from Genesis right on through. But any questions or thoughts about that? I just put a Q question mark right there at that point of review. Yes?
So just to get this for clarification, the potentiality of procreation?
Yes.
So then what's the point of, a couple in their 60s whose spouses have died, what's the point of them getting married if there's no potentiality for procreation? Or for people even in their youth who know that they can't have kids?
Yeah, I think that we have to see the potentiality for procreation as a, I'm trying to figure out the word for it, but it's like not every sex act is a procreational act. God hasn't made it that way. Even within a marriage of a young couple who are very fertile, right? The potentiality is there in the institution and in the general makeup of the human family for a historical unfolding over time. The potentiality there doesn't destroy the other aspects of delight and enjoyment that goes with sexual intimacy in marriage that's implied in the Genesis material as well. So one way to answer that is just to say, I mean, even when a couple knows they can't procreate, they just can't do it, that doesn't mean that, you know, they're in their 30s and they can't have children. Say, I know of couples like that. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't be married or anything. You know, they still have the other aspects of marriage. The potentiality is the way I think we have to frame procreation. And it has, in fact, brought about an earth of people. But in the fall, that has to be a redeemed family, you know, like we talked about earlier. Is that helping you a little bit? I mean, I know it's got to...
Yeah, so, I mean, just the biological, the way that God has made us biologically would be that male and female would bear children. So that's what you're kind of more general than specific people.
Yeah, even within a specific people, it's still a potentiality.
You can say, you know, it's not a potentiality.
But you're saying when you know it's not, when that's been right. Now lost. But it was a potentiality for them from their birth, or, you know, now, you know, and it's just so the potential means it may not be the case in every case. It's not the case in every sexual act, and it's not the case in every person's life, and some people never marry, and, you know, we have other ways to, because of the fall, to try to qualify that. I don't know if I'm helping you or not, but is it? No?
I think
did you say no, or it's not helping?
But I think...
Go ahead.
It's not helping, Connie,
okay.
So maybe you can help her.
Well, okay, maybe you could, can you form it as a question that I could maybe try to...
His question.
Just that question.
Yeah, well, I think the 60-year-olds getting married hits the nail on the head. I mean, if the woman knows. So when you say the potential, there isn't any potential.
Right.
For them.
Right.
At that
right.
time. Yeah.
So somehow we need a different word
yeah.
to say that.
Well, I'm just saying, like he said, you can't, it's a potential within the human family that isn't, that potential isn't the only thing that makes a marriage.
Right.
It is a part of the covenant of companionship. But that potentiality is how we get the human family. That's the point of the institution is to give a family. And that has to be corrected by redemption, you know. But so the potentiality is there along with other benefits or values of marriage, which say when someone knows that they don't, that the potential means probability there could be not. Well, now say we know it's the could be not part. Well, you still have all the rest of marriage, even if you know the not part.
Well, the homosexual community would say, we know that's not a possibility, but we still have all the benefits, all the other benefits.
But see, that with that homosexual relationship, the procreation is not even a part of their relationship.
I mean, it couldn't.
It's not there either.
But the word potential is a little weak in that respect of the 60-year-olds getting married. I look at it as if procreation is an integral part of marriage, but not all of marriage.
Yeah. I think that
I'm playing devil.
I know the way I would answer that, I think, is in the design of male and female and the delight that's there in the Genesis account.
So
that's what I would, where I'd answer that.
I think we simply need to come up with a slightly different tweak on the sentence. I think we kind of know what you mean.
Yeah. Well,
I think
that you know what, when we look biblically of how a marriage is violated, you know, for example, having sex outside of marriage, you know, notice that there's nothing ever mentioned about having kids outside of marriage or the violations. It seems to me that marriage is more than just kids.
Well, sure.
All the other
sure.
things too, you know. So
yeah. Yeah.
So I guess that fundamentally, if you want to have sex, you got to get married. That's where it comes down to me. I think sex is a way the human family is, multiplies is through sexual relations. But if you want to have sex, you got to get married. That's why 60-year-olds should get married. I think.
Yeah, just because sexuality is designed for a covenant bond.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, that's part of my answer. But we're still trying to get the word. Both of them are questioning my use of the word potential. In relation to procreation.
Right. I'd rather use the word design. You know, just you can say two people, male and female, made as such by design, you know, to be biologically capable that was the design. And the product, the outcome of that design is for the most part, children.
It's probably, it's not a difficult issue about the older people where they can't have children if we weren't talking in the debate with some who want to use that as a wedge to destroy a whole other web of biblical teaching, let's say. I mean, if we're going to use the exceptional unusual. Part of my approach in handling that kind of thing would be we're using exceptional and unusual cases. I'm trying to speak in terms of the institution. And so we have these exceptional cases. Now, if you want to, I agree that in our society, I suppose, if you try to make a moral issue a minority group, so you're an exceptional, you know, you fit some kind of special exception or something. The debate is going to have to follow that. I mean, we have to follow, try to field all these things.
Well, and that's the way I'm thinking. If I'm in a real life conversation with somebody, it's someone in the homosexual community who poses the question, as Jonathan just stated, how do I respond to that?
Yeah.
And at this point, it's vague.
Yeah.
You know, we all know what we're trying to say here, but I don't think we've figured out how to say it.
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, on one side, if we talk about the potentiality of procreation, one of the reasons that's justified is it within the normal process of with any couple, it's just not every sex act doesn't lead to procreation. You know, it doesn't. It's a potentiality. Even within a marriage where they have 10 children. Well, the potentiality was to have 80 or 1,000 or whatever, but they have only 10. It's a potentiality. I mean, there's a way of framing that where even in a healthy couple who are fertile, they don't have a conception every time they have sex. So it is a potentiality from that angle. It's a potentiality from the angle of the institution of marriage for the production of the human family, the race, the godly seed. That brings, of course, the design of male and female, that partly is the potentiality issue of procreation, is the male-female biology. What do we do with cases of, you know, all these various exceptional cases? I guess partly I want to just talk about them as exceptional cases within that framework. But there may be, I'm not trying to say I've got the best way to define this in the world. I am trying to account for factors here that seem to be, there is a certain range in which the word potential does some justice to the material, you know what I'm saying? That's all. But it may not do enough for the debate we're in at some time or another.
Go ahead. It helps me to go back to the account of Adam and Eve. It helps me to see that Adam was alone and that he saw all the other creatures had a function. They had different functions. Then God created Eve with a different function than Adam, but they worked perfectly together. That seems like that could go... Could we work that in our definition?
Well, it's the polarity of male and female. I mean, it's the polarity of male and female, maybe. I mean, there's the complementary nature of male and female and the fittedness of Adam and Eve in that sense. But there's also, you know, they're commanded to multiply. I created male and female, Genesis 1, 26 and 27, 28, created male and female, which uses language that reflects on the more on the biology than husband and wife does. Male and female to multiply.
Yeah. Well,
so there's a design of multiplication. Yet it's only a potential. It became a reality for Adam and Eve, but you know that intimacy of marriage is a potential.
So we have that ideal.
But go ahead, John.
That's what's missing, I think, from the sentence. The intimacy. It's not mentioned in your definition.
Okay.
Marriage is a covenant of humanity. Male and female are what? Given to each other exclusively or companionship. With the potential of bearing.
Well, one cannot deny the fact that there's a lot more going on in a marriage than just purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, well, right. I was trying to say that, and you're getting it more explicit. I mean, that's why I said there are other things besides procreation. It is designed for fellowship, for knowing. The very euphemism of the language of sex itself shows that it's a part of the larger covenant of companionship, which is something I wanted to develop a little bit later here. But, you know, so there's that. That is a fundamental part of marriage, a fundamental ingredient of marriage is that covenant of companionship that's expressed, symbolized, I understand it, symbolized in the intimacy. And but then I don't want to leave out the potentiality of children either. As a somehow the design was.
You say, I'm going to stick in the words for marriage with the design potentiality of
procreation. But also we can't deny the fact that, you know, that the sexual relations is enjoyable, I think, by design, that
sure, it is,
but we want to engage in it to, so that human race sort of have this insurance policy, if you want to call it that, you know. Obviously, the insurance policy is God's, you know, God's hands making these things happen, but sort of, there seems to be something to that, isn't there? That we...
Well, sure. I mean, that's why we're... I didn't expand on the word intimacy here. I do keep using the word, and I'll use it. That's one of my euphemisms for, as I'll get into later, the marital intimacy. I think that's a great way to be euphemistic about what we're talking about and to preserve respect for this subject. This is something I want to talk about. Better get to it before long here because we keep going on.
This is very important.
Yes.
To nail this down.
Yes.
I'm wondering if it should be homework.
Well, okay, we could homework. The definition could be revisited. Yeah.
I don't think it's that we don't understand the picture. It's that if we're engaged in a conversation outside of this with a non-Christian or with another Christian who doesn't have the full understanding, to effectively and efficiently engage in a conversation and description or whatever about the subject.
Sure.
Without, you know, because it seems like if we just say that with the potentiality of procreation, well, then
we're going to be
starting
confusion.
On a whole.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't. Right. I didn't present. Okay. Give me this.
That's the point.
Yeah. Give me this much though on this. This isn't prefaced by. This is how we present this to a non-believer or. This is our wrestling to try to understand the subject and work our way to how do we love our neighbor. So I'm totally willing to engage this refashioning this for love's sake. So, I mean, that's where we're going, and this is a work in progress. So I put homework up here for me, I guess, mainly. But we'll try to rework that definition more. You might see it come out better, too, as we progress. And I thought about it myself, how I've, you know, like, there are certain things we haven't defined more precisely yet, even homosexuality yet. And there are other verses I want to get in front of us progressing that will, like the Leviticus text, which will help us to see marriage and et cetera. So things that I hadn't had in mind are coming. I didn't have in mind when I put this little review together. And what we did last week. Did you comment before I go on it, Freya?
Well, my head's going all over. But,
okay.
We were talking about, you know, exceptions to the rule. You know, uh-huh, okay, we have a 60-year-old. We've got the woman that cannot bear children.
Exceptional case.
This is all why? Because of the fall. Adam and Eve were perfect. They were absolutely perfect. I'm sure they were young. You know, they were not old. So because of the fall, then we have these issues.
The anomalies, however we want to call them, yeah.
Right. That, you know, of course, I don't know how long our...
I think that's an important...
It may end up to be a paragraph. Right. That's all about a part of, you know...
If that's an excellent framing point for this, and if we can't communicate that with someone... People who even deny a fall, whatever, in their self-righteousness, we're going to have a lot of difficulty explaining the biblical view. So that on this, so I think creation and fall, the creation structure, we're taken back to Genesis, and the fall and its implications are important for communicating. This is good. I really appreciate this interaction because I already said here, we need to learn lessons here about our battle and Christian love, so... You're reminding me of that in a very good way with this.
I have a question for you. Is a part of the thinking that after this life, marriage does not exist anymore?
Yeah. I'm saying that.
Why wouldn't it exist anymore? In afterwards, is because it doesn't have a use anymore afterwards.
Well, the why is, of course, God's creation and design, and there's some things about that we can't answer, but
sure.
it is, once the, I think I mentioned it in the message earlier, but once the family that is the design, the human family that is the design of marriage, is in glory, marriage falls off.
I don't know if this is, I know you'll stop me if I'm way off, but I actually think of it as when we reach the new heavens and the new earth, we are the bride of Christ. We're all going to be married to Christ, not to each other.
You know? Sure. No, I don't think that's so far. As the bride of Christ, we can think of it as a corporate and individual way.
Right.
And I think a lot of the language of the Bible, God and Israel as an adulterous wife, and this kind of language is also a language that should filter into our understanding of adultery. In adultery, we not only break a covenant with a partner, but we break a covenant with God, who is our married partner, in a sense, a covenant marriage idea. So you've kind of brought that over to the not yet of the kingdom.
My second question is, when you talk about potentiality, I kind of understand what you're saying. Especially when we consider that the main way in which God grows His church, for example, or one of the ways in which God is through kids living with parents who are Christians, that we, as Christians, we teach our kids, but not because we are guaranteed that our kids are going to be Christians, but because of the promise of that,
Sure.
You know what I mean? So
sure.
I guess I kind of see an analogy, something there with regards to...
Yeah, now we're trying to connect the family, the domestic household with the household of faith. And it's not one-to-one, or there's no formula, but there's promise, and there's nurture. And that's the promise is in the way of nurture,
right.
And there's...
In terms of having kids, but there's a lot more going on along the way as you teach your kids about Christ. You do develop a relationship with them, and you love them and all that, And as a matter of fact, Christ, for example, when he describes, when he's trying to get through to us, how he feels about us, is that he uses marriage a lot, the bride and groom, but never about kids. So
What do you mean, never about kids? How
are you? Never... The analogy when he uses the bride and bridegroom, he never brings into it having kids.
That way of focusing. Okay.
He focuses in on the relationship, the love between a man and a woman. He just stop there.
Right, but we get it. You have times when in the Old Testament Israel is the bride, and then Israel's the mother, and then Israel's the mother with many children, and these are related to God. It just carries this theme out to the family.
Sure.
And it's a larger picture here. There's much to be thought about in this whole connection, and I appreciate these balancing thoughts. Let me kick it a little bit further. Okay, we can go back. That's just because we haven't even gotten to today's study, and maybe we won't, but it's just not a problem. But relevant biblical text, after review, I'm just kind of introducing with relevant biblical text. And I say, therefore, so notice this, although there are only a few texts in Scripture that deal explicitly with homosexuality as a breach of the design of marriage from the beginning, I need to read it differently. Let me read it like this. Although there are only a few texts that deal explicitly with homosexuality as a breach of the design of marriage from the beginning, it is included by implication in all passages that discuss sexual immorality generally. Now, that's just one thought, that there's a lot of that comes under when immorality is dealt with in a general way. But then, the critical and explicit text, though, I list here as 7. Genesis 19, Sodom. Leviticus 18, the holiness code, Romans 1, exchanging natural for unnatural, 1 Corinthians 6:9, 1 Timothy 1:10, and Jude 7, unnatural desire. Now here's the pattern we will follow in discussing these 7 texts in 3 steps. going to deal with the holiness code of Leviticus 18. This develops the definition of marriage and sexual immorality. Then we'll deal with Romans 1 with Genesis 19 and Jude 7. Reason being, for real brief here, Romans 1 roots the natural in creation as does Jude with Genesis 19. And then we'll look at 1 Corinthians 6:9 and 1 Timothy 1:10 together, which raise the difficult question of application in Christian law. So that's my order of dealing with the seven verses, really under three heads. Now, we start with the holiness code. We can at least get into it if we just at least get through A, because a lot of it is just outline. But let's see how we go here. Maybe if I read it all and it's just in your mind and we can discuss it next time or however. But here, first of all, I want to say this introduction. The delicate and pungent subject matter. Because of the nature of our subject, some details are best left in the land of euphemism, though our culture contradicts that every day. This is a problem, right? To maintain respect for marriage, and especially for the sanctity of marital intimacy, I will use euphemism as possible. Note the euphemism in this very sentence. Now, did you pick up my euphemism that I already used? Starting with to maintain. Go ahead.
Marital intimacy.
Yes, that's euphemistic to me. And that's a very good euphemism in my mind. Tell me if you don't agree or something about these things, but that's my assessment. Now, I may use footnotes. This is just kind of giving myself an opening up here to balance clarity with delicacy. Maybe I won't. There's just some authors I read, some of that. Well, I might want to talk to you about that. Some things they're ashamed to even talk about, you know, that type of thing. And Paul says, and so, you know, maybe I put it in a footnote, but I'm not sure what I'll do with all that, but I at least lay that out there. Now, some things are better left unsaid, or at least not repeated once they've been made plain. Don't just keep repeating them, you know. Euphemism has the positive function of giving theological instruction, deep God-centered meaning, along with preserving respect. For example, to know one's wife, Genesis, connects intimacy to the context of the covenant of companionship. This elevates marital intimacy as a symbol of the fellowship of husband and wife with each other and with God, at the same time that it reveals its subordinate place in marriage. I hope it brings out both of those, but I want to have both of those along the way. But you can see if intimacy connects with the larger theme of companionship, then it's subordinate to that. It's a symbol of that. So on one hand, it's elevated as a symbol, and it's a value and a pleasure and a joy, etc. But on the other hand, it's subservient to that larger picture. And if that's missing, if that larger picture is missing, you wind up in the divorce court. It's the knowing one another of companionship that is the 95% of marriage, with the 5% being the sexual intimacy. That's kind of what I'm getting at in that. You may have seen some sermons where I've done work with that. All right, then, so that's one euphemism, though. Know one's wife. And then consider how Genesis 2:25 is richly euphemistic by stating they were both naked and unashamed, even though I say it's frank, maybe, but it's euphemistic. And then, you know, because I think there are levels of euphemism. And then for sexual intimacy in Leviticus 18, we have uncovering nakedness and to lie with. These are euphemisms. And you notice how I switched in my sentence at the beginning there for sexual intimacy in Leviticus 18. Sexual intimacy may or may not be marital, right? So now the outline of Leviticus 18. There's a general call to holiness in verses 1 to 5. You maybe want to read some of this week, but we'll be talking about some of these details. Then there are specific sins to avoid in 6 to 23. First, a long section on incest. Second, menstrual uncleanness. Third, adultery. Fourth, child sacrifice. Fifth, homosexuality. And sixth, bestiality. Then there's warning for disobedience in 24 to 30. That gives you a kind of a picture of what we're going to be looking at in 18. Let me go ahead with the relevance. Look, if we have less discussion, I can obviously lay this all out for you in a short time, and then we can pick up discussion next time. We can always go back to and revisit things. But let's just note on the relevance of this code for Christians, because this is a part of the big debate. Questioning relevance. This is a law code for Israel in the Old Testament. It includes blood and dietary laws. That's what the menstrual law is. And then you have these other blood and dietary laws. The holiness code is actually 17 to 26 of the book of Leviticus, chapter 17 to 26, not just 18. So how can it apply to the church of the New Testament? How is menstrual uncleanness a sin? And one that applies beyond a mere Old Testament ritual to New Testament ethics. See the dual questions there. Should we simply follow Swords, a Presbyterian New Testament instructor, who identifies homosexuality as a sin while denying the applicability of Leviticus to the subject? Just, it's Old Testament ritual, throw it all out, so to speak. He doesn't say it that way, but I give you page numbers for him there. Then there are a number of things to consider in defense of the relevance of this code for Christians. I begin with one today. So let me go into it. The first one I would mention, as I would approach the subject, a distinction exists within the code that indicates universal applicability. What distinction am I talking about? Different from things like dietary laws, the matters of Leviticus 18 are identified as sins for which God is bringing judgment on those outside of Israel and for which he will judge Israel if she commits them. Let me read this text. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things. That goes back to that list up there, 1 to 6, incest, and write down the list, and I'm not going to include number 2, but all of that list. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, for by all these the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean, and the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity. That's my key word there. That's the word for sin, iniquity, punishable guilt. All right? Used in a kind of a figurative way about the land, but you know what it's saying. The Canaanites, as well as the Egyptians, were guilty of these things, and because of that, God punished them for these sins. And the land vomited out its... I will drive them out. The land became unclean. I punished its iniquity. The land vomited out its inhabitants. Very graphic language about the destruction of the Canaanites when Israel comes in there. And that's why. But you shall keep my statutes, my rules, and none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns with you. For the people of the land who were before you did all these abominations so that the land became unclean, lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean, Israel, as it vomited out the nation that was before you. All right, let me steer you. Let's just see what we can do for a few minutes, because that only took about 2 minutes for me to read all of that. I have two questions, and I just like, the first one is, they just kind of build, but the first one's kind of like almost matter of fact in a way. I'd like to ask you these two questions and see what your responses are, and then you can see what you want to ask about some of this. But how do these verses, I'm talking about 24 to 30, answer the question of relevance. And then the other one is, how do they govern our approach to menstrual uncleanness? So I'm going to go more particular. But let's start with that first one. How do these verses answer the question of relevance? Do anybody have a thought you want to just... or it doesn't for you, maybe. You know, I mean, the question's loaded or biased in the sense that I've presented it as... It does give us an answer. How does it answer the question of relevance?
Relevance to sexuality?
The point that the Holiness Code, particularly Leviticus 18, is relevant to the subject matter of homosexuality, its ethical, the judgment of it ethically today. So that's what I mean by... It's the relevance of the of Leviticus 18 to Christians today.
Oh, okay.
That's how I'm. Because this is into people today. I mean, people would say, like Swords does. He just says it's part of the Holiness Code, and so therefore, you can't work with it here if we're trying. He's a New Testament teacher and does ethics and things, and he sees homosexuality as a sin. But he says you can't apply that. It's not relevant.
Most of these things are still covered under the Ten Commandments.
Yep. Wouldn't. It leaves number two as the one that's the...
That's not right.
That's the difficult one, so to speak, as we... But yeah, we've got... I don't want to keep going on that because that's actually a point I want to develop, that kind of thought I want to develop more as others on this list. That's just print number one. But try to come back a little bit more precisely to why I cited this way. What am I trying? See if you can get into my thoughts on this.
Are you talking about the menstrual uncleanliness?
No, I'm talking about how do these verses answer the question of relevance of this text to us today? Maybe I should say what in there helps us narrow it down that it's relevant to today, and how does that work? You know,
specifically 24 to 28.
Yeah, in 24 to 28, and particularly in verse 25.
Okay.
Did I have the right verse? Yeah.
Well, iniquity.
Yeah. Now think about this. I mean, I found this in the discussion to be very interesting as I've been reading all these authors and. They say this is irrelevant, right? It's just talking about Israel's holiness code. But here are the nations. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm just saying that you can back it up to the general call to holiness, and this defines what's not holy.
Yeah, yes, of course. Good. And that's a good, that's contextual. And I'm trying to just see the, why are, Israel is going into the land, and they... This people, the Canaanites, are kicked out of there. What have the Canaanites done? These are not Israelites. These are not people under dietary laws. These are not people that are Israelite, God's chosen people.
They're pagan.
They're the pagan Canaanites. They're the Gentiles. They're the unbelievers. Their punishment comes upon them for what? All this list is what? These are their sins. How? Why would it be? I guess I'm trying to. Maybe is that not coming out clear? If it's a sin for the Gentiles, then why isn't it a sin for the Gentiles today? It's a sin for everybody. It's universal. These are universal sins that God disapproves of and punishes people for.
Well, that was an easier statement than if you'd have just said that, it would have been a piece of cake.
Well, I'm trying to get you there. I guess that.
See, he said he wants you to get into his head.
Yeah, and that's what she's having trouble doing. I said, okay, well, fair enough. But I mean, isn't there something to that if you think? This is why God judges the nations, their iniquities. These things are iniquities. They're not just iniquities that violate a ritual holiness code of Israel.
Yeah.
They're iniquities that violate things before God for which people universally will give stand in judgment and be punished. Now, we got to figure out how that is brought into Israel. Because Israel is not to be like the nations, and thus we have this 17 to 26 and this chapter 18 holiness code for Israel that has some reflection and interaction with that evil of the nations. Now, when you go through the list, the hardest one is number two, to think this way. How did the nations commit that sin? How is that even a sin? It's talking about the woman's period, right? The blood, it's a blood issue. How is that even... Now, I'm not dealing with that today. We don't have time, right? Out the door, right? Excuse me. No. But I want to know this about that. If you follow me on the sin issue... My first question, that this is relevant, this chapter 18 is relevant, that you can make distinctions within the holiness code where you can, it's obvious, it's clear, it's simple to say, this is a sin, universally.
Yeah.
Right here, you can say it in these sexual matters. If you agree with me on that, how does that at least set us in our approach to the subject of number two, the menstrual uncleanness question? What does it just do as a general approaching that subject? What does it tell us to do? How does this guide you to approach that subject? What does it already set in your mind? You know, see, I'm just trying to get you thinking about something along this line here. Let me look at my notes on that. But anybody want to jump in on that? How does this govern our approach to that subject? I mean, wouldn't it make you want to open your mind on how the Lord, why the Lord has that there and expand, and you'd want to look in to say, well, what is that itself? What does the Lord mean by menstrual uncleanness? What does that even mean? Wouldn't you want to do that? You want to go into that, right? Not just say, well, there's our perfect answer to homosexuality. It's just a ritual. You want to go into this subject. You want to dig in there and find out what's going on. It's a blood issue, right?
Yeah.
And the chapter 17 developed the blood laws. I'm going to come into that more later, but I'm just talking approach right now. You have a thought on approach, like how you...
Because I've always been confused by the some of the uncleanness laws.
Yeah.
You know... And,
yeah.
You've got to leave the camp for 3 days or wash out the camp, or I forget how it goes. And I kind of assumed that maybe it wasn't a sin, but a symbol of God's standard for holiness, but that by touching the dead body, you weren't sinning. So impurity doesn't always equate with sin. So I'm wondering, yeah, if you say specific sins to avoid. Uncleanness is a sin to avoid?
Well, that's the difference. You're just helping to expand. You've opened up the idea of what's going on here in this kind of uncleanness like the other uncleannesses. And this is kind of like, well, I say, well, is that a sin? Well, you have to say a yes and no about, was it a sin to touch a dead body? Well, not in itself, and for some people, no, but it was a sin if you disobeyed God, right? It was a sin to disobey God, and that's how it taught holiness. Obedience to God's commands, whatever they are. But then, they're also related to certain things about the whole life, birth to death. The menstrual cycle is related to birth and offspring, and it's a blood issue. And so, you know, now we got to still ask the question. So it's, yes, it can be a sin, but in a sense, it's not a sin. It's just a ceremony, right? It's just a ceremonial law, right? It's not a universal sin. It's a temporarily a sin. In other words, God gave this command temporarily. I don't know how to say that exactly, but God gave this command, and we don't have that today as a command, I would say. I would say the menstrual's issue, not having sex during menstruation, is not a law today. It may be better for comfort and decided by a lot of other reasons, but not decided by this text. I would say that. So we still have the question then, how does this work with our sins and the nations? And I'm just saying how to approach it. I want to answer that question in number two, I think, is my list of how I'm going to work through this. I want to answer that question later, but right now, here's part of my approach to it is. My approach, when I'm saying, how should this set our approach? Well, it doesn't, the approach has to be that we have to find an explanation that fits with what the issue of sin is, as we've defined it from verse 25. I mean, is it wrong? This is going to set you in a certain mindset. This doesn't mean that bestiality is not a sin. I've got to deal with number two here, somehow see this in this list of sins in a way that doesn't, lead me to take away sins among the nations. I've got to make this fit. There's nothing wrong with trying to make this fit when we're trying to make it fit within biblical, premises or teachings that are right here in the context, and we're going to have to work with it. And I'm just saying that's leading to where I want to deal with next time. But go ahead, Bill.
I'm still having trouble seeing uncleanness as a sin. Like,
well,
when you read the text,
yeah.
It says you're not to approach a woman who is in the period of uncleanness or whatever. So how is uncleanness the sin? It's not the uncleanness, it's the approach.
Yeah, well, I went back with menstrual uncleanness. I'm back in the law that's not being addressed here. This is built on the earlier teaching about like the touching a dead person and like a person who has a cut and they're bleeding. Those kind of things you have to wash. You have to go through this. If you cut yourself in Israel, if you cut yourself and you're bleeding, you're unclean. If you have you go through a period as a woman and bleed, you're unclean. There's a menstrual uncleanness. And that was the holiness code. It's ceremonial uncleanness. It doesn't mean that the woman has sinned. Now, here, double on topping, if we deal with a ceremonial law like this, then there's a command. God gives a command. And in those, in 17, I think it is, or these other verses, during what sexual activity during that uncleanness, I believe before this very verse is listed as something that's wrong for Israel to do. So it'd come under the category, like I said earlier, it's a sin not in itself. It's a sin for that time within the framework that God was educating Israel with these ceremonial laws. And it does not apply today like that. Those ceremonial laws do not apply today.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Now, okay,
that,
all right.
But I still think in that context, it's not the uncleanness that's the sin. You've got this list of six things. It's the approach.
Okay. I mean, I'm...
to a woman who is in that...
Okay. I mean, as far as our text here is concerned, the uncleanness is... It's trying to figure out... See, what I think where I went with your question is, here's how I'm thinking, just to let you know, and I got to get more specific. I'm thinking of all these uncleannesses as things that need sacrifice for. You have to be washed. You have to be cleansed. It's like they're a sin. But what they are is they're pictures of sin. Maybe it's better. Maybe I should have said earlier to your question. These are pictures of how sin makes us unclean. And they needed to be washed. And they had to follow those rules. So it probably helps your point. And in this text, we have a prohibition related to menstrual uncleanness. And if one breaks that, that would be a sin for that time in that education of Israel under their ceremonial structure as part of God's education of them. And it's not a sin today. I would say.
Do you think
it's a matter of comfort and things like that? So now that brings up then how do we square that with these other things and with the sins of the nations? Pardon me?
If you're having somebody read that and you're saying, well, all of these apply, but this one doesn't today.
What's wrong with that? Does it seem inconsistent to you? Go ahead.
It requires explanation.
It requires, that's where we want to go. That's what I'm going to deal with. That's where I want to deal with that.
But isn't there a bottom line answer to that? I mean, it's
that you're going to have this week instead of next week?
Well.
Yeah, there is. I think it's partly figurative, that the nations, I'm just trying to get ahead of myself on this because you're asking it. I think that the nations did commit the sin of having sex with a woman during her menstrual period. They did that. They did that, okay? And God says, they did what I'm asking you not to do. That was one of their sins.
I get all that.
Okay. Well, so I'm saying it was a sin for them too. It's almost symbolic. They didn't have a command. They had no command out there in the nations about that. Right? They didn't have the law. They didn't have God's commandments.
The pagan nations.
The pagan nations.
But that's not my point. My point is that it's still listed. And if we say you can, all the rest of them still apply, but that doesn't today.
Yeah, that's because you're saying. Are you asking? Is that an inconsistency?
So you can go. So if you're trying to just explain this to somebody, and they're like, "Well, how can you say?" Then how do you describe other things in the Bible that worked then, like in the Old Testament? Now in the New Testament, it doesn't work anymore.
Well, you just raised the question. You just raised what Swords has raised. This is why people just dismiss it all then, because they say you can't make those distinctions. Now I've just said, can't you see? Do we not see that these are called sins? So we get all we get the block, but then we have this one exception. And I'm just saying we've got to open our mind to find the meaning there. And that's the process I would take anybody through. We've got to find out why that's there. Well, sure, how many parables are easy to understand? I mean, if someone is not going to give you any patience and labor to communicate with you, then we're not going to get anywhere with some. We've got to ask for some time and try to figure out the best way to proceed. For me, for us, I just wanted to bring you up to this question and next week expand on the answer to it. I think there's a solid answer to this and why this is included in the list. But someone's got to make discernment, and I think it's just like this. If someone doesn't seek the truth, they'll never find it. But those who seek and ask and knock will find, Jesus says. Things have truth to be found has to be sought. True disciples will learn by working through difficulties. So when I'm calling people to discipleship and trying to explain these things to them, I'm calling them to be true disciples. And they go like this, and they do everything, they do every kind of thing, but you just keep working with them and trying to call them to listen to what the Lord says and make distinctions. Try to be patient and look through it. And then ultimately we have false teachers.
So this will all be cleared up as crystal next week.
Well, I don't know about as crystal, but we will take it on. Here I'm just trying to say, how do we approach it? I'm saying we got to approach it in a way that we're going to make it fit with all the issues, with the issue of Old Testament to New, and with the issue that there are sins in these nations. And how could they have ever done this? How could they have sinned against that holiness code? See, you know, we're going to have to answer that, and that's what I want to do next time. I just wanted to bring you up to the question.
In a word, though, when you say those things were sins, like not touching a dead body, in essence, they weren't really sins in and of themselves. They were sins because they were disobedient to what God was telling them to do.
Yeah. Right. Okay, that's probably the best way to just frame that.
Like the fruit in the garden, right?
I mean, yeah, the fruit in the garden wasn't an evil apple. It wasn't even an apple, right? But it wasn't an evil fruit.
They were commanded not to eat it. That,
exactly.
That became
right.
Sinful.
And this is very important in this entire discussion. It's what has God commanded? I mean, the fruit was pleasurable, and people can enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, but that doesn't. It's the issue of God's command that we're talking. One more thing over here somewhere, with Jonathan.
I mean, would you say that, you know, there's God's sort of his standard that he sets up, his eternal standard based on his character, based on his holiness, that applies to all people, But with Israel, he added another level to that standard and to reveal his holiness in a special way to them.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's probably a good...
The standard became elevated. It was higher for them, like a higher bar even?
Yeah, I suppose you could say, higher bar, I suppose. But the word I want comes to my mind is gospel. All of this holiness code, it's God giving them the gospel. These were all gospel informed ritual issues. They were gospel. They were teaching about salvation by the blood. I'm opening up the door of where I want to go next week, but this is all gospel. So there's an elevated call to them, and the same things that, I mean, these people were doing all these things in the nations, and God says that causes him to vomit. He makes the land vomit them up, and he tells Israel he wants a different standard, and he has a whole structure of what he's teaching Israel and teaching us by the gospel here in the Old Testament. And it's in some aspects of this, of course, it's a be holy as I am holy. You know, but it's also structured by gospel presentation. That's why all the blood laws. So to me, you have to understand the menstrual cycle as a blood law. And then once you open that door, I think the answer becomes real easy.
It's amazing in Israel's, you know, in their day back then, everything you would do would have spiritual significance.
Yes.
It'd be right in front of your face all the
absolutely
time.
Absolutely, and that was the point.
When you eat,
yes.
When, you know,
yes,
every
exactly.
Every single thing you do would
right.
have this spiritual significance.
Which would teach us, whatever you
eat or drink,
or whatever you
yeah.
do,
yeah.
do all right. the glory of God. That's what that was.
The
yeah, sure.
You think?
All right, very good. We can talk some more after.